Amen. If you have your Bibles with you today, I want to encourage you to turn with me back to Mark chapter 14. If you've been with us, you know we're studying the Gospel of Mark. If you're new with us this morning, we've been in the Gospel of Mark for some time now, and we are have arrived at chapter 14. We are nearing the end of the Gospel of Mark. If you don't have a copy of the Bible with you, the words will be on the screen ahead. And also you can grab a pew Bible in front of you and turn to page 1011. And I believe you will find the our verses this morning. Mark chapter 14, verses 1 through 11. I'll read these verses for us today. It was now 2 days before the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and the chief priests and the scribes were seeking how to arrest him by stealth and kill him. For they said, "Not during the feast, lest there be an uproar from the people." And while he was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, as he was reclining at the table, a woman came with an alabaster flask of ointment of pure nard, very costly, and she broke the flask and poured it over his head. There were some who said to themselves indignantly, "Why was the ointment wasted like that? For this ointment could have been sold for more than 300 denarii and given to the poor." And they scolded her. But Jesus said, "Leave her alone. Why do you trouble her? She has done a beautiful thing to me. For you always have the poor with you, and whenever you want, you can do good for them. But you will not always have me. She has done what she could. She has anointed my body beforehand for burial. And truly I say to you, wherever the gospel is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has done will be told in memory of her." Then Judas Iscariot, who was one of the 12, went to the chief priests in order to betray him to them. And when they heard it, they were glad and promised to give him money, and he sought an opportunity to betray him. Our passage this morning reveals the story of one woman's extravagant act of worship, her extravagant act of devotion, but it's also a story about betrayal. In between, or actually on either side of this betrayal, we find this extravagant worship, don't we? We might even say that Mark kind of sandwiches this worship with betrayal. We found that Mark does this often in his gospel. He begins with something, he moves on to something else, and then he'll return to the previous theme or the thought. And he does that for a reason. He does that in order to highlight something or to bring a point of contrast. And we know from reading our verses this morning that the contrast he is making here it's fairly obvious. This unnamed woman's love for and devotion to Jesus versus this heinous act of treachery and betrayal. That's the point that Mark is making. As we begin this morning, I want us to consider if our own worship of Jesus has ever been similar to that of this woman. This woman is remembered, and we'll talk more about her in the time to come. This woman is remembered for this costly action, this visible display of her worship and devotion to Jesus. And I wonder, friends, today if we have similar times in our lives where we also have worshiped Jesus in a similar way. Certainly we are not able to take this type of ointment and pour over the head of Jesus, but I wonder if our worship has ever been described as extravagant. I wonder as well this morning if we have ever been criticized for our devotion and love for Jesus, because that's what happened here in this story, right? This woman was criticized. She was scolded because of her extravagance. She actually offends those that saw her do this. And at the end of verse 5 says, "And they scolded her." I wonder, friends, if we've ever been scolded because of our devotion and love for Jesus. Imagine being reprimanded. Imagine being in trouble by people around you because of your genuine and true love and worship for Jesus. Jesus is right in what he says in verse 9. Even after all these years, we're still talking about what this woman did. Keep in mind the context here of Mark 14. If you've been with us for a while, you know, as I mentioned before, we've been in Mark for a long time now. And we might even say that all that we've said so far, all the time we've spent in the Gospel of Mark has been leading up to not only to this point here in Mark 14, but especially to where we're going to get to, Lord willing, in a few weeks in Mark 15. We're only one chapter away from the crucifixion of Jesus, and we're only two chapters away from the resurrection of Jesus, but we're not quite there yet. We still have Mark 14 to go. It's a long chapter, 72 verses. We find many significant events here in Mark chapter 14. We'll see in the weeks to come that Jesus will eat the Passover supper with his disciples. He'll inaugurate the Lord's Supper. He'll head to pray in the Garden of Gethsemane. He'll be betrayed once and for all by Judas, as we read already this morning. He'll stand before his accusers, and then we know at the end of Mark chapter 14, Peter himself, one of Jesus' inner three, will also deny Jesus. All of this in Mark chapter 14. But before we get to those stories, we have to go back to the beginning of Mark 14. Look at verse 1. It was now 2 days before the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. It was 2 days, Mark tells us, before the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. If you're like me, you'd think, well, what are those things? That sounds kind of strange. I don't know what Passover is. I don't know what the Feast of Unleavened Bread is. And both of these things point us back to the Old Testament. They point us back to the time in redemptive history when God dramatically liberated and set free his people from slavery from the Egyptians. It's kind of like our 4th of July, kind of like our Independence Day from Great Britain. We have to go all the way back to Exodus chapter 12, where we find first written about the Passover and first written about the Feast of Unleavened Bread. The Feast of Unleavened Bread was a 7-day feast which commemorated the initial eating of unleavened bread during this time of the Passover, which the Passover occurred on the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. The Passover, you may recall, was the occasion by which the angel of death was in Egypt at the time, and if God had instructed his people to smear blood over the doorpost of their homes. And as the angel of death went around from home to home, if the angel of death saw the blood smeared over the doorpost of the home, the angel of death would pass over that home. If the angel of death did not find blood above the doorpost, the Bible tells us that the angel of death would strike down the firstborn son of that home. This was the way in which God rescued and redeemed his people and set his people free from Egyptian slavery. One commentator says that the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread were, quote, the nation's most important religious festival. So this was a big deal for the people of Israel. It's not a real big deal for us today, but in those times, this would have been a big deal. So it's in the context of this great anticipation of this festival that we find our story this morning. Continue on in verses 1 and 2. And the chief priests and the scribes were seeking how to arrest him, Jesus, of course, by stealth and kill him. For they said, not during the feast, lest there be an uproar from the people. Here, once again, we find that Jesus' same old adversaries are rearing their ugly heads once again. We've seen over and over again throughout the Gospel of Mark where the chief priests and the scribes are doing all they can to oppose Jesus, to try to get him arrested, to try to get him killed, and all of their hostility and anger towards Jesus is all really about to come to fruition in just a matter of about a chapter, in just a matter of a day or two, when eventually they will get their way and Jesus will be betrayed, not necessarily by them, but by Judas. But for now, at least, they hold back, they pull back, because they say, not during the feast, lest there be an uproar from the people. Why did they not want to do it during this time? Well, there would have been about four times as many people in Jerusalem at this time as there normally was because of the feast. Nationalistic zeal would be at an all-time high. People would be all about thinking about their independence from Egypt, but also they'd be thinking about what they hoped was going to be their independence from Rome. Rome occupied Israel at the time. Jesus was viewed as the Messiah, and they thought that the Messiah was going to liberate the people from Rome. So they understood that this was not the best time to seek to arrest Jesus. We'll see in just a moment that Judas will do the work for them. It's here where the story shifts to a home in Bethany, which belongs to a man, according to verse 3, known as Simon the leper. So Simon the leper enters the story for the first time. This man presumably no longer has leprosy, otherwise he would not be living at home. He would not be surrounded by people at this dinner party. We can speculate, though we don't know for sure, that Simon the leper would have been healed from his leprosy by Jesus. The text does not tell us that, but we can probably assume that that's the case. Bethany's about 2 miles east of Jerusalem, and during the final week of Jesus' life, Jesus goes back and forth from Jerusalem to Bethany time and time again. We've seen that over and over in these chapters. Verse 3 tells us what happens in the home of Simon the leper. Very important verse. We're going to spend really most of our time here in verse 3. And while he was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, as he was reclining at the table, a woman came with an alabaster flask of ointment of pure nard. Very costly, and she broke the flask and poured it over his head. We need to point out that Mark does not name this woman. She goes unnamed here in Mark's account of this story. But if we read over in John chapter 12, where John records the same incident, John actually names the woman. And the woman's name is Mary, none other than the sister of Martha and the sister of Lazarus, who had been healed by Jesus, who had actually been brought back from the dead by Jesus earlier on in the gospel of John. But it seems to me that since Mark does not name her, he desires for this woman to be known not by her name, not by who she was, but rather by what she did. I think that seems to be the emphasis to me in this story. So what does she do? She enters the house of Simon the leper as Jesus and others are reclining at the table, and she enters carrying what the text calls an alabaster flask. Again, most of us are probably not real familiar with an alabaster flask. Well, I found a couple of pictures of what this flask perhaps could have looked like. We don't know for sure what it looked like. These are ancient alabaster flasks that have survived from history, and there's a good chance that this jar that this woman carried looked a little bit like one of those. It was probably a kind of a small, narrow container of sorts. And the text tells us that within this flask, there was ointment of pure nard. You say, Pastor, I don't know what that is either. Well, I really didn't either until I did a little reading and studying. That's when we read the Bible, we have to dig a little bit sometimes because we don't always understand ancient customs. Jesus and people in the Bible lived a long time before we did, and we have to really do some homework as to what this was all about. So what's ointment of pure nard? Well, nard is actually oil derived from a plant. Okay, nard is oil derived from a plant, better known to us nowadays in 2018 as essential oil. Right? Essential oil seems to kind of be the craze nowadays. I don't know a whole lot about essential oil other than the fact that it typically comes in a small bottle and it's pretty expensive if you buy the real stuff. I've been told you can go to Walmart and get the cheap stuff, but I don't think it works as well. I don't know. Maybe some of you could help us out there. But essentially, this ointment of pure nard was kind of like an essential oil derived from a plant in India, and this would have been in this alabaster flask. So imagine something like that full of this, what the text says, verse 3 says, is very costly oil. Verse 3 says the oil was very costly, and she broke the flask and poured it over his head. So she broke the flask and poured the oil over his head. The text, again, says it was very costly. Some commentators speculate that this would have been a family heirloom, that perhaps she had this flask full of oil for perhaps generations. We don't know how long she'd had it. Why do they speculate it was a family heirloom? Well, in those days, most women did not have the means by which to purchase something like this. Culture was very different then, and women typically just stayed at home and worked around the house. And in those days, most women did not have the financial means to secure something like this. And so commentators think, well, how did she come to have this? Well, perhaps it was passed down from generation to generation. This woman, presumably Mary, has this, and in an act of extreme devotion, an act of extreme worship, she breaks her family heirloom and pours this expensive oil all over the head of Jesus. So it's fascinating to think about not only why she does this, but how she does this. I don't think we need to overlook the fact that she actually breaks the flask. Why would she break the flask? As you, well, go, if you can, go back to the picture of the flask. Why would you break the flask when you could simply pour the oil back out? Right, the oil was presumably poured in. The oil certainly did not just originate in and of itself in the flask. Why not just pour the oil back out? Why go to the trouble of breaking the flask? Well, she breaks the flask because this costly act of devotion and love and worship and service to Jesus was the final way in which she desired to use this oil. Right, she had it made. She made up in her mind that this was going to be the way that she used this costly oil. She was not going to use it for anything else. In other words, there was no going back. Once she broke this flask, once she began to pour the oil over the head of Jesus, there was no turning back. She believed that Jesus was worth it. She believed that Jesus was worth this very public, very extravagant display and expression of her love for him. One commentator says that she broke the flask in order to signify, quote, the totality of the gift. I like that. When I read that this week, that stuck with me. The totality of the gift. This was the way she was going to use this oil, and there was no going back. There was no putting the oil back in the flask. Let's think for just a little bit this morning about the extent to which we value Jesus and the extent to which others in our lives perhaps see what evidence there is in our lives that we also value him. Is there such evidence? Could people point to things in our lives and say, yeah, that person really, really esteems Jesus. This person really worships Jesus because their life is different, because they do things that other people don't do. Jesus tells us in Matthew 6 that we're not to make a big deal when we give to the Lord. We're not to make a public show of it. We're not to make a spectacle of it. We're not supposed to worship just so other people will see us and applaud us and think that we are really spiritual. So why did Jesus not kind of get onto this woman for doing what she does? This was a very public thing. There were other people around. She has this expensive oil. Why does he not say to this woman that you've done a bad thing? Because I don't think the other people in this room, on this original occasion, I don't think she even was aware that they were around. I think her focus would have been zeroed in on Jesus to such an extent that she only cared about Jesus and Jesus alone. She probably didn't even notice or care that anyone else was around. It kind of makes me think about the widow's offering at the end of Mark chapter 12. You think back for a month or two ago when we were at the end of Mark chapter 12, and the text, Mark tells us that Jesus is at the temple and he's watching all these people put in money in the offering box. And the text tells us that there is a poor widow woman who puts in two small copper coins, which combine to make 1 cent. Okay, a very meager offering, a very small offering. And if you think about what she does, and if you think about what the woman in Mark chapter 14 do, they are both commended by Jesus. In Mark chapter 12, Jesus commends her and says, out of her poverty, she has put in everything she had, all that she had to live on. So if you think about that woman, by what she gave, this demonstrated that she held God and her faith in Jesus in high esteem and high value, and she believed in what she was doing. And then we come to Mark chapter 14 and find a similar incident where a woman does a similar thing. Both were incredibly sacrificial. Both were incredibly costly. One was worth practically nothing from the human perspective, while the other was worth thousands of dollars, but the amount did not matter. What mattered was the sacrifice. What mattered was the motivation. What mattered was the intent. And Jesus commends both of these women for doing that. And here we are all these years later still talking about what they were doing. What mattered was the object of their worship. And that's, I believe, on clear display here in Mark chapter 14, as it was in Mark chapter 12. Sometimes, friends, as we think about the object of our worship and what we're willing to sacrifice and give up, sometimes we don't like what the stories that our lives tell. Sometimes we don't even have the time to devote a couple hours on Sunday morning to worship the God-man who we believe has rescued us and redeemed us from our sin. Sometimes we don't have the time to devote to the things that we really need to devote our time to. Sometimes we just give a meager amount of our income as offering, not because it's all we can give, but because it's all we want to give. Sometimes we withhold involving ourselves in the ministries of the church because we have too much else to do. And all of these things, whether we like it or not, reveal to us and reveal to others what it is that we esteem most highly. You say, what does it matter if I don't come to church one week? Well, you know, that's ultimately a decision that we each have to make individually. But what we do and with our time and what we do with our money, all are indicators of that which we truly worship and esteem and value. You say, well, Pastor, you can go to church and you can give your money and you can volunteer with everything the church does and still truly not be worshiping God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. Absolutely, that is true. But if we're not doing at least some of these things that God has laid out for us in His Word, then what does it say about the condition of our hearts before God? What does it say about our worship of God? What are we esteeming in our lives? What are we valuing? What story do our lives tell? What is it that we are pointing others to that say, this is what I value, this is what I cherish, this is what I love? You know, why do we do these things? Why do we show up to church every week? Why do we give of our income? Why do we serve in the church? Why make these sacrifices? Well, hopefully because we want to, right? Hopefully that's why we do it. Sometimes our motivations are not always pure, but hopefully we want to do these things and we do them because ultimately God is worthy of these things. And because Jesus is worthy of any sacrifice that we can make. Why would this woman give all that she had into the treasury? Because of what she loved. Why would this woman give this expensive oil and pour it out on the head of Jesus? Because that's what she loved. Why would they do these things? Because, friends, their hearts were smitten with God. Ultimately, I think that's what underlies both what's going on in Mark 12 and what's going on here in Mark chapter 14. They were totally in love with God. Think back to the time, at least for you older folks and maybe some of you younger folks as well. Think back to the time when you fell in love for the first time, right? Some of you, that may put a smile on your face, that may not, I don't know. For some of you, it may have been a number of years ago. I was about the age of some of these students here in the front row. I was about 16 years old. And my heart, and I'm happy to say that the woman that I first fell in love with, I later married. My wife, she was my first serious girlfriend. And I remember being about 16 or 17 years old, just head over heels for this girl in my a grade below me named Katie McVeigh. See, that's Katie McVeigh was her maiden name, and there was nothing that I would not do for her. There was nothing that I would not do to. And she's not even here. She had to take my kids somewhere, so you'll have to tell her that I'm talking about her this morning. There was not one thing that I would not do to get her attention, to spend time with her, to buy her gifts, anything that I could do to be around her and to show my affection and love for her, I did gladly. My brother and I, we had a lawn service growing up, and from middle school on, and I would work hard every summer, mainly so I would have some, eventually when I got to high school, to have some money to do some things, and you know, spending money on her was anything but drudgery. right? And think about where I'm going with this, right? And many of you can relate to that. Hopefully, if you're old enough, that at some point in your life you fell in love. I certainly hope everybody has that experience. And one day, students, maybe you will as well if you haven't already. But when you think about this story in Mark 14 and Mark 12 in those terms, it really, to me, it changes how we understand what this woman did. When you fall in love for the first time, there is nothing that you will not do for that beautiful or handsome object of your affection, right? You are just head over heels and just in rapturous joy and delight over this person that you are just smitten with. And I think that's what's going on here with this woman. She, not in a romantic sense, but she understood who Jesus was, and she understood that he was God, and that she desired to and she joyfully sacrificed for him. Right? There's no duty here in this passage. It's delight. It's joy. It's happiness. She wanted to do these things for Jesus. That gets us close, I think. That's the best thing I could think of this week as I was thinking about how do we make sense of what this woman did? Well, go back to the time that you fell in love, and then you'll understand what's going on here. Quickly, verses 4 and 5. Yeah, we are just about out of time. There were some who said to themselves indignantly, "Why was the ointment wasted like that? For this ointment could have been sold for more than 300 denarii and given to the poor," and they scolded her. Mark doesn't tell us who's in the room at the time. Other gospel writers do. It was the disciples and some other people, the people who should have known better, right? Sometimes we find opposition even in the church and even amongst people who ought to know better when we express our love and devotion in such an extreme way. The text tells us that this ointment could have been sold for 300 denarii. Again, what's that mean, Pastor? Well, one denarius, equivalent to one day's wage. So this was roughly an entire year's worth of salary for the common worker. That's how much money this ointment was worth. That's how much money this essential oil was worth. And this woman breaks the jar, pours it over the head of Jesus. Verses 6 and 8, "But Jesus said, 'Leave her alone.' So they scold her. They say that she's wasted it, which, if you think about it, is both an insult to the woman and to who else? To Jesus, right? The disciples, they should have known better. To say that you waste your money when you give a gift to someone, you are insulting both the giver and the receiver of that gift. Verses 6 through 8, "But Jesus said, 'Leave her alone. Why do you trouble her? She has done a beautiful thing to me. For you always have the poor with you, and whenever you want, you can do good for them. But you will not always have me.'" What an audacious statement for anyone to make other than God himself. Can you imagine the arrogance of someone saying that? But it's not arrogant when Jesus says it's true, because Jesus is God. Jesus was all about the poor. Read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Read the Old Testament. God always has a heart for the poor. Jesus has a heart for the poor. Jesus says, "You'll always have the poor. Do good to them often, but you won't always have me." "She has done a beautiful thing to me." Verse 8, "She has done what she could. She has anointed my body beforehand for burial." Another foreshadow of the pending death and crucifixion of Jesus. Look at verse 9. "And truly I say to you, wherever the gospel is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has done will be told in memory of her." 2,000 years later, halfway around the world, 2018, here we are talking about her. Let's look at how the passage ends. We began with betrayal, and we'll end with betrayal as well. 10 and 11. "Then Judas Iscariot, who was one of the 12, went to the chief priest in order to betray him to them. And when they heard it, they were glad and promised to give him money. And he sought an opportunity to betray him." One of the 12. Judas was one of the 12 disciples. One commentator said, quote, "Proximity to Jesus does not guarantee faithfulness." What a sobering, staggering thought that is. Proximity to Jesus does not guarantee faithfulness. So as we close this morning, let's close not focused on betrayal. Let's close focused on Mary's extravagant act of worship. I want to read to you some lyrics to an old hymn written by Isaac Watts called When I Survey the Wondrous Cross. One commentator pointed out this song as he said that as he read, as he was studying Mark 14, these lyrics came to mind as he thought about this woman just gladly and joyfully giving back to Jesus. Now, the woman in Mark 14 did not know at this point that Jesus was about to die and on the cross for her sins, but yet she joyfully and gladly gave to him this extravagant gift. Listen to these words before we close. He says, the hymn writer says this, "When I survey the wondrous cross on which the Prince of Glory died, my richest gain I count but loss and pour contempt on all my pride. Forbid it, Lord, that I should boast save in the death of Christ my God. All the vain things that charm me most, I sacrifice them to his blood. See from his head, his hands, his feet, sorrow and love flow mingled down. Did e'er such love and sorrow meet, or thorns compose so rich a crown? Were the whole realm of nature mine, that were a present far too small. Love so amazing, so divine, demands my soul, my life, my all." Let's pray.